Hello, and welcome to the ILO's Future of Work podcast and to our special series ahead of the Second World Summit for Social Development taking place this year in Doha. I'm Zeina Awad. Well, 3 decades ago, thousands of delegates and representatives of countries, civil society groups, and non-governmental organizations came together for the first ever World Summit for Social Development in Denmark's capital, Copenhagen, with a single overriding purpose: to work together in partnership towards advancing social development. The summit concluded with a promise to build a world that is socially integrated, free from poverty, and where full and productive employment is actively promoted. Well, it's been 30 years since those commitments were made, and today we ask, what has been achieved, what still needs to be achieved, and how can the upcoming Second Summit for Social Development breathe life and energy into global cooperation so that we can close any gaps and deliver on all the promises made in Copenhagen back in 1995? And to help us answer these questions today, I'm joined by two wonderful guests. Online, we have with us Professor Sabina Alkhair. She's the director of the Oxford Poverty and Human Development Initiative, and her work on multidimensional poverty has reshaped the way we think about poverty, inequality, and development. And here in the studio with us, we have our very own Manuela Tomei, the ILO's Assistant Director General for Governance, Rights, and Dialogue. Thank you both for being here, and welcome again. Professor Alkhair, I'll start with you. When you look back at the last 30 years, what stands out to you as our key achievements and progress?
The good news is that things have changed. In 1995, there were 5.7 billion people on the planet. Now there are 8 billion people. But if you think of extreme income poverty, in 1995, 2.25 billion people lived in that condition. And now it's 800 million. These are by the World Bank's $3 a day poverty line. If you think of children in school, in 1995, only 55% of children attended secondary school, and now it's 77%. And similarly, the number of children who complete primary school has risen from 81 to 92% globally. And so there are many, many different indicators that one could look at. So there have been tremendous accomplishments.
When we look at the world of work, Manuela, what has changed since 1995?
The Copenhagen Declaration was a reflection of both a shift in the way development was thought about, and also an accelerator, because indeed social development was seen as a precondition and not just the outcome of economic growth. So by bringing together the eradication of poverty with full and productive employment and social integration, there was a very clear indication that if you want to make inroads into poverty reduction, you definitely need to also look at how full and productive employment can help sustain that progress in order to prevent people from falling back into poverty. 3 years after the summit of Copenhagen, the ILO, in a tripartite manner, as you know, we are a tripartite organization where governments, employers, and workers sit at the table and negotiate very often, very lively, about how to shape workplaces globally. They came up with the Declaration of Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work. It's absolutely essential if you want to prevent or address poverty and contribute to shared prosperity, you need to level the playing field among countries and within countries, among enterprises and workers. And hence the importance of having these fundamental principles and rights at work respected and observed. I think what is absolutely new in this declaration is that there is an obligation to observe these rights by all member states, regardless of whether they have ratified the fundamental conventions. This is something major. And as a result of that, and in the context of, the follow-up to that declaration, there have been a number of very important measures that have been taken nationally, but also globally, including, for instance, the inclusion in trade agreements of provisions and clauses relating to the respect of these labor rights. Another very important consensus which emerged at the summit and which has had very important implications for the world of work is the realization that if you really want to promote full and productive employment globally and in a context of an open global economy, you need also to advance the respect for fundamental principles and rights at work. And today, I think that nobody challenges any longer that child labor, eliminating and preventing child labor, is part of social development. Indeed, the Convention on the Worst Forms of Child Labor has been ratified by all ILO member states.
Indeed. And I'm not sure if any of this could have been accomplished if different players and actors did not work together in partnerships. So, Professor Alkar, when you think about this, what role do you think partnerships and cooperation played in making Copenhagen a success? And how important really was multilateralism at the time in terms of helping us to achieve the outcomes that were achieved?
I think was very fundamental. And it was embedded in Copenhagen in different ways. Of course, there was interest in how to take the peace dividend and invest it in human development as an outcome. But there was also a very important recognition that these different aspects of social integration, of poverty, of work, are also themselves interconnected. And there needed to be integrated policies that would be more cost-effective, have a higher impact with lower fiscal burden. And so a very strong call for people to study them together and address them together. And that was very important, but that, of course, required experts with different knowledge across sectors of government or across different agencies to work together and say, you know, now if we take the problem from the perspective of the protagonist, the impoverished or disadvantaged household, then how do we understand the best ways to address the issues that they face at the same time when they wake up in the morning? And that also could not be done by just one line of institutions. It required collaborations and partnerships. And so the ability to compare across countries, to learn across countries, but also then to address the wider challenges that come up requires international and global actors. So I think that partnerships came up very much out of that space, but in a way that has really proved its relevance if you just cast forward into the need to break silos, the recognition that integrated or multi-sectoral policies can have a higher impact on poverty reduction for the same cost.
Multi-sectoralism, partnerships, cooperation, all mentioned by you, Professor, and Manuela, I see you shaking your head throughout.
Yes, I think that the very way in which the declaration was constructed, which is highlighting these three key objectives to be pursued in order to attain social development and the interconnections and interlinkages across these three objectives, required by definition coordination of the players and actors and institutions that deal with each and every of these pillars and objectives, and try indeed to get together and understand what are the interlinkages, and think also in a more integrated manner, mm-hmm. and trying to look at what might be the trade-offs that might be involved, or how to reduce such trade-offs, and how to engineer social policies and economic policies in a way to, attain certain outcomes. And at the same time, I think the declaration of Copenhagen was calling for a people-centered framework for development, which is based on partnership and cooperation, which is very much aligned with the ILO's way of operating, right? We are a tripartite organization, each with each party representing very distinct constituencies and needs and interests. and dialogue and social dialogue, as we call it in the ILO, being the mechanism whereby these three different actors and all other players that are essential to deliver on the commitments and promises of the declaration come together. So there is a modus operandi which is at the heart of it and which is very much needed today. And I think I would just like to refer to how to this, you know, cooperation and partnerships has tried to have an impact on the daily life of people and workers in particular. So I would like to refer, of course, we are a normative and a standard setting organization, which, however, does not only set standards, it tries to translate those standards into a reality for those concerned. So one is the Domestic Workers Convention, which was adopted in 2011, which was really groundbreaking because for the first time it was stated very clearly and loudly that domestic workers who are still mainly women, and women coming very often from rural areas or migrant women, were workers, and as such they are entitled to protections like any other workers. But of course they are living and working in particular environments which requires certain measures tailored to that environment for these protections to be effective. And it has triggered a significant amount of change in national laws and policies.
Mm-hmm.
So now in many countries around the world, domestic workers are entitled to one day off in a week. They are entitled to a minimum wage. They are entitled also to access to health care. There is now an International Federation of Domestic Workers Organizations that have joined the International Trade Union Confederation. So, I mean, this what happened in Copenhagen contributed to this, to making them visible and active contributors to society and economies.
Indeed, I mean, you've both really highlighted important accomplishments. I would say turning point accomplishments in areas as wide as education, health, labor, gender equality. So a lot has been achieved, but not everything. We know that there are still gaps. So Professor Alkar, what would you say we still need to achieve? What we've targeted, but we haven't been able to achieve since Copenhagen 30 years ago?
I think there's still many, many people who have very acute levels of deprivation that can be addressed and she must be addressed. And they must be addressed holistically in an integrated multidimensional way. And we also need to recognize that people now need incentives. And measurement is part not just of seeing where we are in terms of the goal of addressing these preventable deprivations that cast a long shadow over the rest of life. Somebody's out of work, or a child is working, or somebody's not in school, or undernourished, or they lack a durable house, or clean water, adequate sanitation, electricity even. And when these things happen at the same time, then a household is particularly struggling. So what needs to be done is, one, to know where we are, to have a baseline, to have performance indicators, so we can celebrate progress, and so we know where extra attention and investments are required. But the second is to be very efficient, to use information on these interlinkages, on the simultaneous deprivations that people are experiencing, to look at a new generation of integrated and multisectoral activities that are based on data and that are based also on now many years of experience countries have in how to reduce interlinked deprivations together and how to use management systems, coordination between national and lower levels of government to do so most effectively, and how data actually can be a catalyst alongside that process.
And when we turn to the world of work in particular into labor, Manuela, what are the key gaps that stand out to you?
Income inequality really remains a major barrier to both advances in poverty reduction and to economic growth. So just to give you an example, you have the top 1% of earners that capture nearly 19% of pre-tax global income, and the bottom 50% only earns 8% of the total. The fiscal space is shrinking in many countries, actually, as Sabina has been highlighting. But I think this is a very crucial area in which we need to put our heads together, including with financial multilateral organization, in order to, you know, come up with an effective action to reducing inequality. When it comes to the situation of women in the labor market, in employment, the situation is stalling. There was some slow progress in terms of both activity rate, employment rates, reduction, but very, very slow and minor in terms of the gender pay gap. And this despite a number of laws and programs that have been launched. 50% of the world population still is not covered by any form of social protection.
We're on the eve of the second summit for social development in Doha. And I don't think it's controversial to say that multilateralism is under strain at the moment. International cooperation and multilateralism. Professor Alkar, do you believe there is enough political will at the moment in the world to be able to work together and to be able to at least try to close these gaps and use the next social summit as a vehicle to do so?
I think we have to create the community of people who are committed and dedicated, and they can do amazing amounts of things. So I'm not a politician, and I wouldn't comment on the likelihood of multilateral agreements. But what I would say is that looking at the people who are wanting to make change, partnering with them, using all of their connections, and really joining hands in this time is inspiring to others. And we are privileged to be the secretariat of a South-South network that works on multidimensional poverty. And what we've observed is that some of the leaders in countries who've done great things in reducing poverty often then are able to encourage others to retake that commitment. So if you think of child labor, of the children who are working, 31% of children 5 to 14 who are working don't go to school, and 59% of children 15 to 17 working don't go to school. And so these overlaps now we can document. And with that, we can prioritize. And with that, even with fewer people and fewer resources, I think there can be change. And the last thing is, I think that there will probably need to be some headline figures and indicators of change, and not a huge, huge number. Because I think with the SDGs, it's been very challenging to obtain the data, to analyze the data, and to know where to prioritize. So the hope is that the social summit will, in a sense, distill, prioritize. For us, we hope that monetary and multidimensional poverty globally and nationally.
Manuela, do we have the kind of environment of cooperation to be able to take the work forward?
Well, the environment today is, of course, very different from the environment in 1995. Right? In 1995, there was faith, I would say, in the benefits of democracy. There was plenty of hope with regard also to globalization, that globalization would have brought plenty of opportunities for the world. However, that being said, one can always look at things as, a glass which is half empty or half full. Yeah. And I would like to see the current situation as a half full glass. There have been very clear examples of success. Yeah. So change is possible, and transformational change is possible. So we need indeed to better understand what can help in terms of getting that transformation ongoing and how to preserve it. And this requires certainly a lot of investment, continued investment in data collection and the identification of indicators that are actually capturing what matters. Sabine was talking about the importance of strengthening alliances and building on the community of the willing. And I think this is, again, it's very important because by also acting together and showing that things can be changed in a particular manner, this will have also domino effects. And I think that there is one major, I see Doha as an opportunity for the multilateral system to make the case for the continued need for multilateralism instead of rivalry. Mm-hmm. Rivalry will not let us achieve any significant change in terms of reducing poverty, shared prosperity, and ensuring that nobody is left behind. So I think these mm-hmm. are the elements that are needed in order to make Doha and the post-Doha a success.
Two sober but positive assessments. Sabine Alkhair, Manuela Tome, thank you both very much for being with us today, for sharing your insights. You really have helped us to take stock and understand what's been achieved and what still needs to be achieved and why the stakes are so high in Doha. That was Oxford University's Sabine Alkhair and the ILO's Manuela Tome reflecting on progress and gaps in social development and on the challenges ahead for the 2025 summit in Doha. And in the coming weeks, we'll continue to explore the issues on the agenda in the second summit for social development, so make sure you tune in. You can follow the series and get updates on the ILO's work on our website or by following our social media channels at ILO on Facebook, LinkedIn, TikTok, and X, at ILO.org on Instagram. For now, thank you for listening and see you very soon on another episode of the ILO's Future of Work podcast. It's bye for now.